welcome to today's program titled Update on Preparing for the Trump Administration, What Employers May Expect. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our host for today's call, Kathy Prosser. You may begin.
Well, thanks for joining our webinar. Two national firms, Davis Wright Tremaine, a law firm, and Woodruff Sawyer, a risk and insurance brokerage firm, have teamed up to provide a broad perspective on what employers can expect in this very fluid environment. I'm Kathy Prosser, the National Employee Benefits Practice Leader for Woodruff Sawyer, and I'm here as your host. Given we have a packed hour of insights and analysis on these key areas of legislation with two extremely knowledgeable attorneys, I want to jump right into this valuable hour of time we have together. Here's our agenda. Chris Martin, an attorney at Davis Wright Tremaine on all areas employment practices, will be providing insights on EEOC and the DOL regulations and enforcement specific to FLSA and OSHA in her engaging, matter-of-fact way. Her deep expertise is needed now more than ever. Next will be Jennifer Chung, our Woodruff Sawyer ERISA attorney, who really prides herself on making all things complex simple. We'll be bringing insights on the Affordable Care Act, having just returned from Washington, D.C. last week. She'll be in high demand as we follow the proposed health reform changes. You know, my last comments is to set expectations. We're in a very fast-paced environment where what might have transpired over a month is now transpiring in a day. We want to give you our best insights and analysis on what to pay attention to as it impacts your business. This is about indicators, like what to watch as well as what you should plan for. I'm going to turn it over to Chris.
Good morning. Our first subject we're going to talk about is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC. As most of you know, all of you probably, as you're in HR, this is the agency that enforces the anti-discrimination laws. So here's what to watch for. The commissioners. There's a new Republican appointee and a Republican chair. So Victoria Lipnick is, and in fact, I just heard her speak in a webinar last week, so I have some insights on where they're going, directly from the horse's mouth. So there are three Democrats and Victoria Lipnick and one open seat. One of the Democrats' seat is up in 6 months. So in 6 months, there will be a majority will be changed over to Republicans. There's another, the other two Democrats, one is going off in 18 months and the other in 30 months. So at that time, we will have five Republican appointees and they will completely control the EEOC. So there may be some changes in priorities. The general counsel position is open now. I'm going to talk about each of these subjects a little bit more in depth. The litigation enforcement focus may change. There might be a lessened focus on that. The new general counsel obviously will be Republican and help set the litigation strategy for the agency. budget may be cutbacks. Usually when Republicans are in control, there's budgetary change. And we'll talk a little bit about the local focus instead of the national focus that we expect to see. So here's EEOC's current strategic enforcement plan, eliminating barriers in recruitment and hiring. I really don't think there's going to be much change there. Number two, protecting immigrant, migrant, and other vulnerable workers. Obviously, there's going to be a lessened focus on protecting immigrant and migrants, but other vulnerable workers, older workers, workers with disabilities, I think the EEOC is still obviously going to have to focus on them. They have a congressional mandate that's been in effect since Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, and that's not going away. Three, addressing emerging and developing issues. Some of the hot issues now that Victoria said they're going to focus on, economic and job growth, a little more than protecting employees. Number four, enforcing equal pay laws. This is still going to be a priority, according to Lipnick. So they're trying to continue to gain the support of female workers by this enforcement priority. Number five, preserving access to the legal system. They have reduced the EEOC backlog significantly. Some cases still sit for months, though. Any of you who have EEOC claims pending know that they can sit there for not only months, but for up to a year or more. And number six, preventing harassment through systemic enforcement and targeted outreach. They're still talking about that, and really a focus on educating employers to try to prevent harassment discrimination rather than the enforcement focus. And even the Obama administration was focused in that direction too. So general counsel, the former general counsel is David Lopez. It's unknown who the new one will be, but they will be a Republican appointee. We expect that that person will have a lesser focus on the EEOC bringing its own litigation against employers. So I think we're going to see the number of cases drop down clearly. Next, what to watch for, some of our takeaways. Look, this is a charge-based agency. They wait until somebody files a charge, although they can do their own investigations, but mostly it's charge-based. The statutes are unchanged. There's not going to be any repeal of any of the discrimination or harassment statutes. But the commissioners are expected, according to Lipnick, the new chair, that they will vote on more proposed litigation before the general counsel files it. So if the board is conservative, the commissioners are conservative, you might see fewer cases approved for litigation. But some priorities are going to be remaining in place. Harassment, sex, religion, national origin, sexual orientation and identity. The agency's unchanged, but we, of course, expect with a Republican appointee to the U.S. Supreme Court that some of the advances made in sexual orientation issues may be unhinged. The new commissioners could also undo the agency's position that sexual orientation and identity are protected under the Civil Rights Act as gender discriminations. Possibly more business friendly, maybe leave as an accommodation. We've had some good cases that have started to erode on attendance being an essential function of the job. Might see some changes there in some of their guidances. The EEO-1 form, of course, now is employers are required to add pay data to that. That's going to stay until there's a Republican majority, so probably nothing on that is going to change for a year at least. Recently, I want to make sure everybody's aware that guidance has been issued from the EEOC, which basically says this is how we would likely rule on these issues. On retaliation and national origin, they issued a resource document on mental health in the workplace, Victoria Lipnick said they're going to continue to focus on harassment prevention and supervisor training. So that's what we can expect in those arenas. So one message she had is remember that the key words in EEOC are employment opportunity. So whereas perhaps prior administrations were focusing on the equal, she has made it clear they're going to focus on the employment opportunity words. So that's what to watch for with the EEOC. Now, what is the DOL up to? I think a lot of people might not know just how extensive the Department of Labor is. There's 29 agencies all under the umbrella of the Department of Labor. OSHA, Wage and Hour, OFCCP for federal contractors, Bureau of Labor Statistics, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. All of these agencies are all under the Department of Labor arm. So they really do have far and wide reach. Now, the Secretary of Labor, former was Tom Perez. As you probably all know, Andrew Puzder was the CEO of the CKE that owns the Carl's Jr. chains, was proposed to be the Trump's nominee. He withdrew his nomination late yesterday, and just as of 20 minutes ago, we learned who the new Trump nominee will be. It's Alexander Acosta, who is currently the dean of the Florida International University. He was a member of the NLRB back in the early 2000s, appointed by Bush. Previously, he was a deputy assistant AG in the Civil Rights Division. where he would have been enforcing civil rights laws. Yet he is a Republican and a Republican member when he was on the NLRB, a Republican member of the NLRB. So he's worked both sides of the fence, but we can expect that he is fully on board with the Trump administration's, well, whatever it is day to day, the Trump administration's position on enforcement opportunities at the Department of Labor. Congressional leadership, the Republicans control all of the key committees that can pass legislation that is enforced by the DOL and can oversee their regulations. So maybe some more business friendly. We don't anticipate repeal of any employment laws, you know, significant employment laws. And the big action will be with the regulators, most likely, in the department, not with congressional leadership. So Trump personnel changes. Obviously, many, many of the people in the DOL and the EEOC are career folks protected. And so they're not going to be changing. But the leadership at the top, assistant secretaries, some deputies for those assistant secretaries, of course, all the secretaries, are going to change. But all that career staff stays in place. And so it's going to be really hard to move this huge ship called the Department of Labor that has thousands of employees. And there will be a new U.S. Solicitor of Labor who will replace Patricia Smith, and that is going to, again, as with the EEOC, impact litigation priorities. So you're going to see probably less activity in the litigation against employers from the Department of Labor also. So here's theoretically the Trump enforcement emphasis. Again, more education and outreach, just like Victoria Lipnick said the EEOC was going to do. Probably less egregious penalties, although in all the cases I've ever had, I have never had any liquidated damages or civil monetary penalties awarded. So if you establish good relationships with the local Department of Labor investigators who are handling these investigations, I think it's pretty easy to get them to do a wrist slap rather than any significant penalties. Inspections, there have been thousands of investigators added to all aspects of the government, IRS, DOL, EEOC over the years, and especially during the Democratic administrations. So they're not going to be able to fire all those people. So they're still going to have a large staff of people doing that work. And it's kind of hard to turn it off. It's possible that the Republican administration will slow or freeze the rate of growth, but probably not wholesale firing of investigators. And again, the litigations will probably see a plateau, maybe a drop. But when the EEOC takes less enforcement actions, it spurs individuals and their individual attorneys to file civil suits instead to obtain redress. So I expect that collective and class actions, state and federal, will continue to grow. And that could be worse. Sometimes it would be much better to be facing the EEOC in court than private litigants in a class action. Next, some anticipated rule changes. The statutes and regulations are largely going to remain the same, but there are a few regulations that are going to be rolled back. So the first one I know everybody's been in an uproar about for the last year is the FLSA white-collar exemption regulation, which raised the minimum salary threshold from around $23,000 to over $47,000. That is dead. It was supposed to go into effect December 1. North Carolina court issued an injunction preventing its enforcement, and that has been appealed. However, the Trump administration is apparently going to instruct the Department of Justice not to continue to pursue that appeal. So, in essence, that's dead. Now, is there a possibility that the regulators may inch that $23,000 salary threshold up? Possible. But probably only maybe to $30,000, $32,000, $35,000, clearly not $40,000 or more. Next, the USDOL persuader rule. Many of you may not have heard about this, but there was a rule issued that any consultant, including law firms, that assisted employers in resisting union organization, and that was expanded to a very broad definition that even included, for example, I do manager training, frontline managers and supervisors on communication skills, maybe some union avoidance, but even that kind of work, even if it wasn't union avoidance, possibly could have fit within the definition. So there was a grace period where we could get agreements signed with our clients to agree that our work would not be have to be disclosed. You would have to disclose the all of the consultants, how much money was paid, et cetera. It was a very, very burdensome rule and would have endangered the attorney-client privilege. So that rule will probably be, that's probably dead too. The next two things, many of you who have been involved in either EEOC or DOL investigations may have encountered the joint employer theory, where PEOs, temporary agencies, are all considered joint employers with the employer to whom they lease or loan or give the employees. Also, there might be a company that has several companies owned by the same person, or even different groups of people, but they have some common ownership, and the departments were taking the position that they were all joint employers, and so maybe a big fish who had deep pockets would be brought into litigation when they weren't truly the frontline employer of the employee who was suing or had a claim. The independent, that theory, we may see a lessening of enforcement of that theory. It's unclear. But be very careful. If you have multiple entities that somehow are controlled by the same or similar ownership, or where HR is all handled by the same department, even though it's for separate companies, you need to be very careful in trying to separate out those, or you're all going to be held liable for a mistake by one of them. And we help employers do that all the time. Next, the independent contractor issue. This is a very hot issue, misclassification. And the government has come down hard on this because the feds are losing income tax and losing income when people are supposedly misclassified as independent contractors instead of employees. I still think this is going to be a hot button issue. I had several cases recently where my clients have had independent contractors who are no longer consulting with them, no longer affiliated with the company, and they file a workers' comp claim or they file an unemployment comp claim, and then the issue of their independent contractor status comes up. Or they file a wage and hour claim, claiming they should have been employees and should have been paid overtime, et cetera. So I think those two theories are still hot button issues for private attorneys. They have been hot-button issues for the feds. Every single department of the federal government and some state agency enforcers, too. There may be a lessening in this area, but I wouldn't count on it right away, so still be very careful with how you're classifying independent contractors. There's separate federal tests, separate state tests. In fact, within each state, there's usually a slightly separate test for the common law theory, a statutory theory for workers' comp, unemployment comp, and for the Department of Revenue. So this is an area fraught with danger, and you really need to make sure your independent contractors really meet the legal test to be an independent contractor. Otherwise, they need to be an employee. Blacklisting, there's been this push to make federal contractors reveal if they've ever even been accused of discrimination or harassment, and then they would be blacklisted. That's probably going by the wayside. So if you are a federal contractor, you probably will not have to face those additional requirements. So potential rule changes, federal minimum wage. There is a possibility the Trump administration and Congress will slightly raise the federal minimum wage in hopes of staving off states from making really big increases. That's still under consideration. Trump even said he would consider it during the election. Workplace violence in healthcare, there's been a real increase. Will there be maybe some kind of legislation or rules on that? Who knows? Jobless statistics, maybe some changes in how they are calculated to try to make it seem either better or worse, depending on what is most beneficial to the administration. Prevailing wage, there's been a push by some Republicans to on government contracted jobs to take out the prevailing wage requirements, possibly reduce them or change how they're calculated. So these are the four areas that we've heard a lot of chatter about. Next, we want to talk about state and local laws. This is really where the action is. There are still a lot of states democratically controlled. And in those states and municipalities, they are raising minimum wage, paid sick leave, scheduling requirement laws. For example, you have to notify your employees 2 weeks before you change their schedule. Absolutely crazy requirement for example, restaurants, fast food, retail. It would just be impossible for that to happen. Safety and health regulations, joint employer coverage, those kinds of issues that DOL normally handles, since we expect them to be more soft on those issues and more democratic focused, it's a real possibility that states and municipalities are still going to do that. You're also seeing a number of states where Republicans have taken control, and so they are going the other way. So we're seeing both things happen depending on if your state is controlled by the Republicans or the Democrats. Probably the most important thing, and this is what we'll end on before we turn to the ACA, and Jennifer will educate you on that. This is probably the biggest change, that most important change for the future of our country that we're going to see. And it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican, the key is this will be a significant change, is the Supreme Court appointment. And here's the issues that will likely face different scrutiny and possibly different outcomes with a new Supreme Court. Class action waivers, agency rulemaking, claiming that the agencies have exceeded their powers, so rules would be rolled back, and we're going to see more strict statutory construction. In the Circuit Court of Appeals and district courts, you're going to see more conservative justices on HR issues, transgender issues, immigration, gay rights, but you're not going to see any kind of change in the fundamental discrimination laws and how those are interpreted by the courts, because that is clearly set in precedent. So now I will turn it over to Jennifer, and hopefully we will have some questions that we might be able to answer at the end.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. I am very excited to be here. I wanted to preface after that exciting segment by Chris that this is going to be an appetizer type of portion. Normally I would go into more detail, but all we're going to be able to cover today is a morsel so we can whet your appetite. And we'll take some questions at the end. So as Kathy had mentioned, I and one of our senior colleagues went to the Hill last week, and we participated in a legislative summit that was hosted by a wonderful organization called the Council of Insurance Agents and Brokers, and we had an opportunity to hear directly from ranking members of the House and the Senate on both sides of the fence, and we were able to hear what their key concerns are, what they expect within this short time period, where they are with the ACA, what's going on. So we have some details to give, but it's still sparse. And it is a wildly interesting time. Regardless of where you are, whether you're dreading the changes, you're excited about the changes, it all adds up to a formula that is interesting. So quickly on the sequence of events, this is one of those times where past history is an indication of the future. So there was a mini repeal bill of the ACA that was passed by Congress last year in January. And President Obama had vetoed it at the time because of concerns about liability and the fiscal deficits that it would raise. So we're not going to go through every one of these, but in the first 100 days of office, there was a lot of anticipation because now we have a golden opportunity with a Republican president and a GOP-run Congress. Now is the time to strike and make changes that would be more difficult in the past if you didn't have those two key components. So within the first 100 days, at the time before he was sworn into office, President-elect Trump had said, oh, he's 90% of the way through a replacement bill. And then key members of the GOP said within a few days of being sworn in, they would be able to present a bill to start the process of repealing the ACA. And in anticipation, on the very first day, Trump signed an executive order called Minimizing the Economic Burden of the PPACA Pending Repeal to help to really give us an indication of where they stand. And the last component that is very key is getting a new Secretary of Health and Human Services confirmed. And that was Tom Price. He was just confirmed last week. Okay, so we actually have Trump's 100-day action plan to, quote-unquote, make America great again. And three of his things that he's going to do that actually will impact the ACA directly will be assigning new leadership to the key agencies. So that's Health and Human Services, the Treasury, and Labor. And then he's going to nominate a new justice, which he has done, to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. There are cases pending that deal with the ACA, the taxation, and all those things that are just waiting. So it will be a key component to have a justice ready. And he wants to fully repeal and replace the ACA. So that's part of his 100-day action plan. We put it right here, his promise and his pledge to the American people on Election Day. And you can see on page 2, repeal and replace is part of that. I've zoomed in here. He wants to fully repeal Obamacare, and there's a couple other things he wants to do. And we'll talk about this when we go into the three leading candidates of what a replacement plan is going to look like. All right, so how about the mechanics? How can Congress possibly repeal the ACA? Well, normally, if you want to pass legislation and be filibuster-proof, you need 60 votes. The Senate doesn't have 60 votes. They've got 52. So in order to pass, they need 60. They don't have it. So the filibuster was created to save the minority from the oppression of the majority. And we'll go into detail about that in some other presentation. So because they don't have 60, then another method they could use is the budget reconciliation bill, which is what they passed last year. Now, with the budget reconciliation bill, you only need a simple majority. So you need 51 votes. You don't even need 51 senators. You need 50 senators that go with it, and then Vice President Pence would come in as the 51st vote. So that is a much easier vehicle and a tool, the tool that would be anticipated on how to repeal certain things. But there's a caveat. In order to have the repeal in the budget reconciliation bill, it has to impact the federal budget. So there's a lot of rules about it, but it has to be within a certain window. So you can't say, well, 40 years from now, we see, the budget going off the cliff. So that's too far. It would be extraneous. So it has to be directly impacting the federal budget and within a more immediate proximate time. So ACA-related taxes, subsidies, penalties, that kind of thing. So I've listed out most of the things that are anticipated to be passed. So individual employership mandates could be repealed, but it's not actually on repeal. You just reduce the penalties to zero, which in essence is the same thing, gets you the same place. The CALEC tax, wildly unpopular. That's definitely going to be one of the items that will be put into the bill, and that it is to tax plans that are rich. So if it is above a certain threshold, there will be a 40% excise tax placed on those plans. So that's definitely going to be out. The marketplace exchanges, right now the federal government runs or facilitates more than 30. 37 of the states use the government to help them run the exchanges. So that's going to be dismantled slowly. They'll phase out subsidies for individuals who now don't make very much money and they get a subsidy in the marketplace to buy individual coverage. They're going to phase out Medicaid expansion. The ACA expanded Medicaid to make it possible for more lower-income individuals to get coverage. They're going to take out, remember when it used to be that over-the-counter medication, you could get it reimbursed through your FSA or HRA? The ACA prohibited that, but they can now remove that. And the caps on health FSA is at 2,600, although not many people actually cap out 2,600 for fear of the use it or lose it rule. What they cannot put into the budget reconciliation, either because it does not directly impact, it's outside of the budget window, or because it has nothing to do with fiscal policy at the time, would be the current prohibition on pre-existing conditions, having children, employees' children up to age 26 being eligible, not having waiting periods longer than 90 days, the prohibition on annual and lifetime dollar limits on essential health benefits. Right now, you cannot rescind, cancel retroactively someone's coverage, with very limited exception. There's an enhanced appeals process and mandatory external review under the ACA. That cannot be repealed through budget reconciliation, and all in-network preventive health services are free. They also cannot repeal the ACA reporting requirements themselves, but you could lower the fines and the fees to zero, which would be actually a relief to many of our employers, because that is a very, very big pain point. One thing I brought up last year when we were meeting with Senator Feinstein's staff members, ACA reporting is very, very painful for employers. Anyway, so before we go into the three replacement plans, let's talk about statistics so we can paint a broad picture of what's at stake. And we are very careful about where you get the statistics. So right now, anything in these slides will either be directly from the Congressional Budget Office, from Health and Human Services, some other federal agency, or the Kaiser Family Foundation. And I put the link so you can read these amazing briefs all for yourself. So right now, 20 million people have coverage directly because of the ACA. That doesn't mean that they're enrolled in the marketplace, but because of the ACA and the expansion of Medicaid, 20 million people have coverage that they would not be able to have before. The vast majority of those who are enrolled in the marketplace, 83%, receive a federal subsidy. They get help to pay for their coverage. If you're between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty limit, you can qualify for a subsidy to help you pay for coverage. The Republicans, part of the replacement bill will be to dismantle the exchanges. But they can't do it right away. They will not pull the plug so that people are left high and dry. They will do it in a phased-out process within 1 or 2 years, so people will have time to be finding replacement coverage. All right, now, 20 million people on their own are getting coverage. Now, on the employer side, out of the 270 million Americans who are under 65 years old, 55% of us receive coverage through the employer-sponsored system. So 150 million people are getting coverage through the employer-based system. It is a terrific system. It is stable. It works. This is one of the key things we talked about at the Legislative Summit, and that we really focused on is, do not dismantle the employer-based system. It's steady. We know what to expect. Employers need it anyways to be competitive. So that's 150 million people. You'll see some stats as high as 170, but it'll be at least 150. So the concentration will be that the focus is that we have to raise revenue. And one of the largest federal spending portions is with the exclusion of premiums from taxable income. So that's 41% of the federal subsidies. That's a big portion. Trillions of dollars is at stake there. The other big portion would be federal funding towards state Medicaid and CHIP programs. That's 43%. Now you compare that to 10%. 10% of the federal subsidies goes to individual marketplace subsidy. And that's directly from the CBO. And that makes sense because we've got 150 million or more people on the employer-based system. There's a lot of revenue that's being missed or bypassed because of the exemption of premiums from tax. Here's where the GOP is having a very difficult time. If we look at this poll, which was taken in December, 1 month after the election, we have an equal divide split. So 49% of the people polled want to repeal the ACA, 49%. However, if you delve into the numbers, 28% want to wait to repeal until they can see the details of a replacement bill, because you don't want to replace the ACA with something that is worse. right? That would serve no purpose at all. 20% hate it so much they want to repeal right now. They don't care. They will wait until deal with the replacement bill later. So that's only 20%. So if you take the 20, and I know 28 and 20 do not add up to 49. That's a rounding issue. I am pretty good at math. Don't worry. So 40%, 47% do not want the ACA repealed. 47% recognize that there are a lot of components of the ACA that do work, that benefits Americans and workers, and so they do not want it repealed at all. So when you add 47% and 28% who want to wait on the repeal until there's a replacement, we've got 75%, over 75% of people do not want it repealed right now. And that's a huge barricade, a stumbling block for the GOP to be able to push forward. It slows their roll. They have to carefully think about, can they get a replacement bill that people will stand behind? And so here's a chart of what that I just talked about. And you can see the slice of the pie with the orange 28% who want to wait until they see a replacement bill and the 47% who don't want to repeal at all. That is a giant portion of the pie. So that's the difficulty and why the 100-day period where we had formally anticipated repeal, that's likely kind of a pipe dream. It's just not going to happen. All right, so now we're going to focus on the three replacement bills that are going to be the front runners. So, of course, it would be Trump's replacement bill, his 100-day action plan, which we had talked about earlier, and he's going to focus on three key areas that will, and I put them here because it will be a repeating theme in the other two proposals as well. So fully replacing the ACA with health savings accounts, making it possible to purchase insurance across state lines. So I'm here in California, and I can purchase a policy in North Dakota. And the final thing is to get the federal government out of the business of running Medicaid. Let the states manage Medicaid, cap Medicaid funding, and let the states handle it. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan's plan is called a Better Way plan. Sometimes you actually hear it referred to as the Blueprint plan. So that's not often, but on the Hill they do call it the Blueprint plan. So if you hear it, that's what this is. And so he also will focus on the availability of HSA. He wants to increase limits, make it easier to get in, just make it a little bit less onerous. He also wants to make it available to have tax credits so that individuals could buy insurance on their own. And this set tax credit will increase with age, but it has nothing to do with income. So it's income neutral, and it just has to do with age. He hasn't put out dollar amounts, concrete dollar amounts yet, so we don't know. Another pain point is with employers who run wellness programs. Right now, the EOC is in the business of regulating the wellness program indirectly because, you know, there's a limit on how much incentive you can have to promote a wellness program, whereas the HIPAA has a different limit. So they want to take the EOC out of it, leave it in the hands of HHS and HIPAA. Permit employers to do standalone HRAs. That is a very interesting concept because right now, under the ACA, you cannot have a standalone health reimbursement account. You cannot, as an employer, pay or reimburse an individual to go get marketplace coverage. That is a prohibition. So he wants to bring that back in. Allow small employers to pool together to create a health plan pool so that they could actually have more leveraging power to get better premiums. Same with individuals. Now, this directly contradicts rules that we have in place, the MEWA rules, which will not permit that. So multiple employer welfare arrangements are not allowed under the federal regime and in many, many states like California. So that is something, therefore, if they're going to make this happen, they're going to have to revise other laws as well. He wants to, as similar to Trump's plan, is allow purchasing of insurance across state lines. And there's a lot to talk about on that end, but not today. So those are the things that he wants to do that would be considered an increase or a new allowance. And I did this as a visual right here on this page, six things that he wants to do that would be considered an increase or a new method of doing business. For the takeaways or the things that are impactful, the thing that you want to take a look at is capping the pre-tax treatment for contributions under employer-sponsored plan. What that means is, right now, employers can, whatever they pay towards your premium as an employee, plus what you pay as an employee towards your premiums, both of those are tax-free to you. It is not included in your income. Well, the Better Way plan would put a limit on how much of that could be excluded from your income, meaning that you would have to pay some taxation on both the employer side and the employee side. So that is something that's different. He would get rid of the pre-existing clause prohibition and instead create a one-time open enrollment, one time. So at one time in point with one window, everybody can enroll, whatever your condition is, healthy, not healthy, very sick, you can do an open enrollment, and then after that window is closed, you must maintain continuous coverage if you want to get coverage for your pre-existing condition. This is going to be tough, right? Not everyone is going to either be able to afford to enroll at that time or what have you. So that means that where do they go? Well, maybe they'll have to go into a state's high-risk pool. So another portion of Paul Ryan's plan will be to help states create high-risk pools and help send some federal funds their way. He's proposing about $25 billion to be sent towards the high-risk pools, and that's not per state. That's divided amongst the states. And by predictions, $25 billion is not going to be nearly enough, not even close. But, you know, it's better than absolutely nothing. And the last thing I want to focus on is that they want to cap Medicaid funding. So remove the Medicaid expansion, let states choose how they want to get Medicaid funding. And it's going to be, you know, simplified, reduced and simplified. So we're going to go here towards what the things are that will affect states. So eliminating the exchanges, right, the federally run exchanges, now you can purchase across state lines. The federal funds for high-risk pools, so federal funds will be sent to the states for the high-risk pools, $25 billion to be divided, and capping Medicaid funding. Now, that is going to put some pressure on employers. That will be interesting. So I apologize, I should say per capita. So right now, states can choose. Every head that's enrolled into Medicaid, you can get a certain amount funded. I think federally, you get about 55%. The federal government chips in 55% towards the state's big bill. Or the states can choose instead to get a block grant amount, so a fixed dollar amount, and the states would have all the freedom to disperse it how they want for Medicaid. So that's Speaker Ryan's plan. Now we're going to go to Tom Price's plan, and he has been a long time not a fan of the ACA, we'll put it that way. He is a former doctor, and so he just thinks that there is a better way to make patients come first. The key legs of his program are, well, he would do a refundable tax credit, very similar to the Ryan plan, except he's got dollar amounts in here. He said he's not married to these amounts, but he's got them in here. So it would start at $1,200. Let's say if you're 18, it's $1,200. And then if you're over 50, you'd get $3,000. So again, this is based on age, not based on your income. So you would get a flat amount based on your age. Now, it wouldn't be available if you have employer coverage, Medicaid, and Medicare, or TRICARE, but you could opt out of those things so you can get $1,200 or $3,000. But, you know, I mean, for me, that's not going to cut it. I'm going to stay on my great employer plan. Now, let's say you do choose to do the credit. You will get $3,000. Let's say you were able to find coverage for $2,500. You would get $500 back. That would be tossed into your HSA. So if it was possible and you got the skinniest bare bones plan, maybe it's possible for you to get a little bit of the refundable credit. Another portion of his plan will be to provide a flat dollar amount, a refundable tax credit amount, so that people can contribute to their HSAs. So that's another expansion of the HSAs and availability of it. So even for Medicare participants, that's really brand new, even for Medicare participants, they could make contributions to the HSA. That's not currently allowed. In fact, a pain point of employers is with the timing of when their employees become eligible for Medicare and they're making contributions to HSA, when turn it off. That will be a thing of the past if this goes through. Another similarity we see with the Paul Ryan plan will be to get EOC out and let HIPAA be the governing rules when it comes to wellness plans. Tom Price is very committed to moving us away from a defined benefit system. So instead of having, you know, this is a set amount of, you know, what's going to be covered, he wants to move us to a contributory system, so away from defined benefit towards defined contribution system. And in fact, he's also a proponent of possibly privatizing Medicare and then giving individuals vouchers instead. That's going to be a very tough sell, because once you deal with Medicare and privatizing Medicare, now you have to deal with the AARP and with the older Americans who have a lot of voting power, and they come out in giant blocks to vote. That is going to be a very difficult sell, but interesting to pay attention to. Similar to the Ryan plan, Tom Price will get rid of the pre-existing prohibition, clause prohibition. So it will exist. You will get guaranteed issue, though, if you can show you have 18 months of continuous coverage. So if you have 18 months of continuous coverage, you will be issued a coverage. So let's say, for example, if I have tuberculosis, that's my pre-existing condition, and for 90 days, for whatever reason, I just didn't have coverage, so I have a gap. And so I can't show that I have 18 months of continuous coverage. Well, what's going to happen to me is when I purchase my individual coverage, I'll have to pay a higher premium. So I'll pay 50% more than what I would have paid had I got continuous coverage. So if my coverage was $1,000 a month, now I'll pay $1,500 a month for 3 years. And what do I get for my $1,500? Well, for 18 months of that, I cannot get my pre-existing condition covered. So anything related to my tuberculosis, I cannot get covered until 18 months and 1 day. So that is how that's going to work. Where do people go if they can't get the coverage for those 18 months or benefits covered? The high-risk pools. That's where they're going. So another similarity, and I keep saying that because a lot of these will have very, very similar components to them, because the focus of the GOP is to raise revenue, lower corporate taxes, but somehow raise revenue. And one way to raise revenue is by capping the employer's deduction. So let's say my employer pays $80,000 for my very rich, very deluxe coverage. Well, for me, it will be they can only deduct $18,000 if I get self-only coverage, or if I have my family, they'll only be able to deduct $20,000 on their corporate income tax return. So that is one way to generate a lot of money. But, you know, if you think about this, this is works exactly the same as a Cadillac tax. What's the difference between taxing something that is, you know, rich and excessive, so you're going to tax a portion that's above, or you just get rid of the exemption for it? It's really the same thing. It's just cleverly packaged, right? Cleverly packaged. So we have to give them credit for thinking and spinning this well. Okay, providing states with funds to create high-risk pools. This is the same as the Ryan plan, but look at the dollar amount now. Price would propose a $3 billion subsidy to be sent to the states. So if we thought that $25 billion was not going to be nearly enough, $3 billion will be woefully inadequate. But that's better than a sharp stick in the eye, right? So, okay, we'll take it. He'll let policies be purchased across state lines. One of the worries about that is it's going to be a race to the bottom, so that the state that has the least protection, consumer protection, that's where all the policies will be issued out of. And unless you live in a state like California or any of the coastal states that have more consumer protection, you just be subject to whatever the insurance carrier wants to offer at that state. Okay, what are the steps that have already been taken that show the erosion other than the executive order? So the 21st Century Cures Act, this is one thing that we can concretely point to that has changed the landscape. So it removes qualified small employer reimbursement accounts from the definition of the ACA. What does that mean? That means that an employer that has less than 50 employees, now they can have a standalone health reimbursement account so that they can pay employees to go to the marketplace to go get their own coverage. Whatever your coverage is, here's a fixed dollar amount, you know, have it. We're not going to offer coverage at all as an employer. So those are the requirements. You have to be small, under 50. You cannot offer any other coverage, health coverage. You have to 100% as an employer fund it 100% by the employer, and it has to be made available to all eligible employees on the same terms. So that's a non-discrimination issue. So you have to not be able to discriminate on offering the terms. And the limits cannot exceed $49.50 if you're single, or $10,000 if you're a family. So maybe as a small employer, you decide it's going to be cheaper for you to just have a health reimbursement account, pay your employees, or reimburse them to go get coverage elsewhere and be done with it. The second thing is Trump's executive order that he signed on his very first day of being sworn in. It directs Health and Human Services and all the agencies that are in charge of the ACA to waive, defer, or grant exemptions, and delay is not really going to really work, but to grant exemptions on anything that's ACA related that imposes a fiscal burden on the state or costs money to this group of people, individuals, families, healthcare purchasers. So what is an executive order? I could spend 30 minutes on what that is and the limits to it, but it's basically a recommendation from the president to the agencies that he's in charge of. So Health and Human Services, the Department of Labor, and the Treasury. And it's like a please reconsider whether we can do this. Please consider or write or draft and take my recommendation and try to waive or defer our fees. Unfortunately, an executive order, though, you really can't delay something that's already effective. You can't delay something or repeal something that's already has official guidance or is an official regulation. You can only give some indication. So for us, it's just an indication of where it's headed. And once Price gets going on the regulation, he can write new regulations, certainly, but that takes time. There's an administrative process you have to go through that takes time. So he, in his executive order, he stated again, you know, he wants the agencies to help states cooperate so that they can implement their own healthcare program. He wants to encourage free interstate commerce so that, you know, the spin is you want consumers to have better choice with healthcare. I mean, look, with the 401k realm, sometimes having 35 mutual funds as an option in your plan is not a great thing. Less is more sometimes, but not everyone agrees with that. So if complying, but he stated in his order, because this is true, if complying with the executive order to waive, defer, delay is going to be contrary to current regulations or need to revise regulations, then all the agencies have to follow the very strict Administrative Procedures Act. You can't just delay something that is in effect right now. What are your takeaways? And I will address some questions after if we have a few more time. But here's the key takeaway, right? So before I even go into my bullet points, the Republicans and the GOP, they want to raise revenue. It's important for them to raise revenue to lower taxation. Health care reform is top of their list, and so is tax reform. And they've got to figure out a way, how are they going to pay for health care if they repeal the ACA. One thing that I didn't mention on here that was a lot of buzz in D.C. is the border adjustment tax. And boy, that's going to be a doozy. Basically taxing goods and services that are imported in and not taxing goods and services that are exported out. And that is supposed to raise trillions of dollars, and that would be where the gap would be. Anyways, a full-scale repeal and reform is just not going to happen for this year. It cannot happen. They don't have enough seats in the Senate. They just don't have the votes. And because Americans are a little bit afraid of what's going to happen to their coverage. So Trump has said don't expect anything until 2018. Paul Ryan has said, well, maybe end of this year. But I think that's very unlikely. Tax reform is a high priority, as I said. They really want to boost the availability of HSA. So if you are an employer or your employees have resisted entering into the HSA realm, the writing is on the wall. It's going to happen. It's going to be a big push. They want employees to take a more active role into contributing into their own medical spending. And when you're an informed consumer, when you know you can get an MRI for $600, why would you pay $1,800? And that's the purpose. Regulatory relief cannot be granted via executive order. I think our president is starting to understand that with his executive orders. And the administrative process is the way to go for the agencies. It takes time. It's a very lengthy process. So even with the executive order in place that says, oh, please waive, please defer, please delay, it's very uncertain. Are they going to waive penalties that have been assessed prior to today, or are they going to go ahead and waive it just going forward? Can they get rid of the penalties and assessments in prior years and go without that revenue? That's unknown. So what should employers do? You know this. You have to continue to comply with the regulations as they are today. Put your best leg forward, and as Chris said, maybe enforcement will be light, but that does not mean it will be zero. There are a lot of career people at the agencies who are very proud of their work. They've done good work. They have really worked very hard to put regulations into place over these years, and they're not quite ready to just let that go. So I'm sorry for the whirlwind. I love this stuff. This is so interesting to me. I hope it's interesting to you. I hope I revived and resuscitated your interest in the ACA. And you know, we'll have a couple minutes to take questions.
Okay, hi, this is Kathy, and I'm going to give Jen just a minute to look at some of these questions because many have come in regarding the ACA in particular and some of the points that you brought up, Jen. So I'm going to turn it over to you when you're ready to take on a couple of those questions. Clearly, there's a lot of interest around, I mean, some I think are interested in if I, you know, don't want to comply today, should I not? Well, I think she answered our question that that's going to be, you know, tougher to do. I think we want to wait until we get guidance. But there were some other questions as well if you want to pop into any of those.
Okay, so we've got a few minutes, and thank you, Kathy, for stalling so I could read these questions. So states that have expanded Medicaid incorporated those changes into their state plan. Will those states have to retain their expansions until they amend their state plans? Absolutely. Things will take time. Medicaid will not be pulled, and the expansion will not be pulled right away. Even if I think the House did start a proposal repeal bill, budget reconciliation bill, but that's stalled. So everything's going to take time. So you're absolutely right. I have a second question. Aren't the majority of the 20 million covered due to the ACA also Medicare and Medicaid eligible and simply shift over? That's right. So 20 million have gotten coverage either due to the marketplace itself or through the expansion of Medicaid. But Medicare is on the block. People are looking at it and figuring out how do we shore up Medicare so it will be sustainable over the long run. It is on the block. They're going to have quite a lot of obstacles on that. When a DC type, next question, when a DC type plan eliminates shared risk, which is the fundamental feature of any kind of insurance, when it impoverish most patients who have expensive chronic conditions like MS. A DC plan, well, it's kind of like when we had pension plans run a few years ago, right? And we shifted the burden away from employers and put it on the employee to make sure that they were contributing enough into their plans, and then all the burden of figuring out what to invest in, how to invest in, how much to invest in, is all on the hands of the employee. This would be a same kind of thing. It would put some patients in a worse position. If you get sick, you know, you can't predict that stuff. Unlike financial freedom, you cannot predict. It's very difficult. So this is true. Okay, so another question is fiscal burden. That does not apply to employers required to file the form 1094 and 1095C, correct? So if I have 600 employees and don't file, am I still subject to the penalties? Yes. So one very important part today is for ACA reporting, you must file on time. You do not have to file well. It does not have to be complete. It does not have to be correct. You just do a best faith effort, but make sure you meet that deadline. Send out those 1095s by the March 2nd deadline, file it with the IRS, and there will be very strong forgiveness. So you can count on that. That has been mentioned, and that is something that I think we're pretty certain about. Will FSAs see lower allowed amounts or removal from tax-exempt status? It is all on the chopping block. In fact, FSAs, it's hard to say. It might see higher. One of the proposed plans says, hey, you know, no more use it or lose it. If you have an FSA balance, they're going to allow you to roll it into your HSA, which is huge, which means that people will now not be terrified to participate in the FSA. Folks hate to lose money, so you're going to shift it over. And that's going to conclude our Q&A session. I promise for all the other questions, we have quite a lot, I will email everyone.
So one question we have been getting, just to finish this off, is that we've asked if we will have access to these slides and also to the presentation. Both Davis Wright Tremain and Woodruff Searle will be posting this on our websites for review, and we will also, via email, send out slides to those interested. So we will. That will be on Tuesday, correct? So that will be like a little bit of a delay. So we thank you again for your participation and hope that we shared some great insights for you in this ever-changing environment. Thanks for joining today.
And a link to the online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. And this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.